Page 1. Panel 1. Wide establishing shot. An Underwood typewriter sits at a desk. There is a sheet of paper in the Underwood. No words are yet on it. A stack of crisp white sheets sit next to the Underwood. The rest of the desk is populated with the detritus of most writers. Pens, empty cups, photos of loved ones, notebooks leveled with a variety of bookmarks and fluoro stickers, mash-up figures of Iron Fist riding a tauntaun. The usual. Caption. I'm writing. Here we have six small panels below it, each a snapshot of something going on. Not the whole image, just a piece of the overall puzzle. You'll figure out the pacing. Panel 2. Two hands cradle a coffee cup. Panel 3. The sun sets. Panel 4. A hand holds a TV remote control. Panel 5. A mouth chews on a pen end. Panel 6. A bike in silhouette winds through a city park against some water. Panel 7. iPod headphones sit in an ear. Panel 8. A thin, wide panel along the bottom of the page. Our faithful narrator sits on the balcony of his apartment. He's sitting back in his chair, relaxed, one hand up, rubbing his eyes. We can see him, the balcony, and some area around him, but not too much, because we'll zoom out for the next page. Caption. It might not look like it. Ellipses. Page 2. Panel 1. Splash page. Here we have panned back and our narrator's hands are both behind his head. He is smiling. The top of his head looks like the Underwood, and we can see the paper now has words on it. So it looks a bit strange, but I'm sure you'll make the blend work. In the apartments around him, through the windows, we can make out all sorts of different stories. See how many windows apartments you can fit into the splash page while still making the stories within them make sense? But we should definitely see the following. In one window, a werewolf sitting in a chair eating a bowl of cereal. In another window, the window is cracked with a 10-year-old child standing alone at it. We have a bearded Canadian writer weeping softly with a bottle of Kraken in his hands. We have a couple making sweet, sweet love up against the glass. Beyond them, we can see the man's wife opening the apartment door and looking shocked. Her bag falls from her hands. In another apartment window, we can see a man in a suit placing a mask that looks like a human face over his actually fiery visage. And in the final apartment, if you can fit it, let's have Jeremy Holt networking with as many comic creators as you can fit into one room. Oh, and if there's room, why not, one room full of water with an Atlantean soldier meditating in the middle of it. A lone caption sits at the bottom right. But I'm getting stuff done. This is my process. All right, listeners, hidden in that script, you'll find all the glorious hosts of the process. Me, I'm Ryan K. Lindsay. I'm the man who sits on his ideas like the penguin in the storm, gathering the process just right. And then there's Jeremy Holt, the man who can turn an idea into pages faster than a storm can set in. And finally, we have Kurt Weeb, the man whose emotionally charged pages are often the storm from which we seek shelter or nod to the rhythm of. Lads, how are we this afternoon?
Oh, I'm in awe. Once again, you've taken the elegance and put it to the page, and now I'm just going to sound like a complete babbling idiot for the rest of the hour.
Excellent. Just what I was aiming for. Jeff?
It was very good. I tell Curtis all the time that you should be doing audiobooks.
I will read the audiobooks of Green Wake. There we go. There's an offer.
Oh, that'd be so awesome.
I'll just try not to cry while I'm doing them. But I would love to throw down the challenge if there's any listeners out there that can draw those two pages. I'd love it.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that would be very cool.
Oh, yeah. All right, sounds like we're good, boys. Sounds like we're ready for a big chat. So, Jeremy, take us away on the next section.
Okay, so this is the section of the wow factor, which we like to, not just talk about ourselves, but talk about other people and other creators and what basically knocked our socks off this week. And I'm going to actually start because I'm always the last one to chime in on this section. serendipitously, I know the listeners don't know this, but Joe Casey actually wrote us a very glowing email about the show and really believes in what we're doing about shedding light on the process of writing comic books. And my choice of the week actually was Butcher Baker. But I'm a little behind, so I am referencing issue 4. I think it's up to issue 6 now. Issue 7 comes out at the end of October. But it's a fantastic book. We've talked about Huddleston's art. I love it because he's taken the idea of superheroes and made it very subversive. And there's this one page in particular in issue 4 where, if people haven't read the story, it's basically this guy who's this Captain America type and the government wants him back. He's retired and basically they want him to wipe out all of the villains that are locked in this, government prison. So he decides to do it as one last hurrah to the Golden Age of superheroism. and he doesn't get all of them. So a couple of them survive, and they decide to, you know, obviously get back at him. One of which is this villain named White Lightning. That's this beautiful woman that's basically made of electricity. And but in issue four, she's been rendered to this basically this ice cube. And the villains that he's up against now are dangling her body over this open city scene, and they know that him and Butcher Baker and her had a relationship, so they decide to just drop her on the concrete. And there's this panel where she makes impact with the concrete, and he's running over to where Butcher Baker is, and he says, "You can't imagine the sound of human breaking in half, and you wouldn't want to." And then he's kind of lying there, and all these villains are kind of like, you know, happy and gleefully just stomping on her body. And one of them says, you know, "Yeah, I hope you fucking loved her. Want to make you cry about it." And he's like getting ready to kind of kick ass, and he says, "Fat chance. I've never been in love, whatever that is. But she was a good fuck, and I'm pissed off." And it's just, that was just awesome. Like, you know, the superhero who, you know, is a person, and you know, villains, you know, superheroes and villains are almost cartoonish to most degree. But what Joe Casey does here is that, you know, they're just people. Yes, they're dressed up in costume. Yes, they're fighting each other, but they're people, and they have human emotions. And it doesn't matter, you know, what side you stand on. You still, you know, you react like a person. And Huddleston's art is fantastic. It's so much fun, and he really pushes the boundary. I mean, this whole series pushes the boundary on what's okay, I guess, to show in a comic book, because there's a lot of nudity, and there's a lot of just in-your-face humor and crude humor. But overall, it's just awesome. Everybody should be reading it.
There's a lot of penis in it too, Kurt, so you'd dig it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. I've got a reputation already.
Hey, you're doing this podcast, that's for sure, man. I agree, though. That book is pretty killer. It just, it's unlike anything else. And yet, that's not what makes it good. The fact that it's really well written is what makes it good. Not to mention the art is, yeah we've mentioned Michael Huddleston before, the art is phenomenal.
Yeah, I got the first issue, and unfortunately, my summer reading kind of teared off, and I was really busy, but I didn't get to follow up with that. Maybe I'll just get the trade. Oh, I'm trade waiting. I should say that. I know.
Way to kill the industry, man. Why don't you just slice it open right now?
Well, here, I'll move on to my pick of the week, and this is going to surprise you, gentlemen. Mine is a DC Comics number one Batwoman.
Oh, I've heard good things.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think most of my stuff that I've been promoting on the Wow Factor has been indie stuff, but I've been hesitant to jump on board the whole DC relaunch just because I thought it was a bunch of hype, but there was a lot of creators out there that were part of it that I thought, oh, you know, I'll give it a chance. I did read Animal Man based on Ryan's
I did too. Very good.
Nod, and I loved it. I thought it was excellent. Really, really good. I also got Swamp Thing. And I thought that was good as well. But of all the ones that I picked up, I think I picked up about 10 number ones. Batwoman was my favorite. It's by J.H. Williams III and W. Hayden Blackman. And Batwoman is, I know nothing about her. And I'm going to be honest, for all those listeners out there, I've never really read DC. And so I really came into this with very, very little knowledge about especially this character. And the art is absolutely gorgeous. And what I really like about it, there's a supernatural vibe to her story. But really what drew me into this story the most was the really interesting paneling that Blackman uses. And, I mean, there is some traditional paneling, but not very much. Literally each page, it's almost every single time you flip, it's a double page spread. But they're individually paneled, and they're laid out in a really interesting way. And there's one that I think is probably the best in the entire issue, is a two-page spread where they've come across the body of a young girl. She's 13 years old, and the whole background story is there's this kind of Latin American inspired story where there's this spirit that's abducting children. We don't really know why, and one of these children turns up dead. And in the center of the page, which divides all of the panels, is this really awesome kind of Mexican-style art spread of this skeleton with fish floating around it, and its hair and its kind of spiritual form goes off the pages and divides the panels. And it's just a really interesting, I mean, I'd read through it really quickly the first time because, you know, there's a lot of content in there, but I was finding it hard to follow the panels because I wasn't used to the art. And then I went back and read it again, and it's just each page is something new and something really, really beautiful. So I'm going to follow this one. Batwoman, I think the writing was really good. The art was fantastic. And truthfully, I think it's my pick of all the number ones. I was fairly disappointed with a lot of them, actually. I tried just a bunch of new titles, The Suicide Squad, which, it was painful. It was funny because I sat there reading. It was downstairs in the basement, and I decided, I'm going to go through this whole stack today. I'm going to read them all. And I went through a real slew of things that were just I put the comic down, and I'd look at my girlfriend and just kind of make this whimper and then move on to the next one. But there were some good ones, and Batwoman is definitely one of them. So, guys, if you haven't read it yet, I definitely recommend checking it out as part of this whole, New 52 relaunch. It's one of my favorites.
Curtis, did you read Batman number one by Scott Snyder?
Yeah, I did, and it was really good. That was an example of where I felt like, as a non-DC reader, I could enter in and read it. And it was like, oh, yeah, I get it. I know there's enough here going on that I can read this as a standalone. But one of my frustrations, and I'm going to be honest with this as well, is that I went into a lot of these series and I was like, they are talking about a lot of things that I should already know. And I really enjoyed Wonder Woman. I did buy that as well. But I felt that there was a lot that they were assuming that I knew already about the character and about even the setting, which was kind of a frustration for me.
Yeah, the one number one that I bought maybe three of them. The one that really stood out to me, believe it or not, was Aquaman. Huh. And if you guys haven't read it, you should just pick it up and just read the first one because, everybody has this preconceived notion of who Aquaman is. He's just basically a joke. And Geoff Johns does this really smart idea of playing that up, but in a really cool way, and he really makes Aquaman look grade A badass. And you guys should just pick it up.
I haven't read a lot of Aquaman, but when they did Wednesday Comics, he made an appearance in Jimmy Palmiotta, his Supergirl, and he turned up and he was riding a dolphin and he speaks into a clam mobile phone and he was a real blowhard. And Jimmy Palmiotti sort of said, I based it kind of on, I think it was Dennis Leary in Rescue Me. And you read the character like that and, man, it was awesome. Like, it worked really, really well. I'd buy an ongoing of that douchebag. But I haven't picked up the Aquaman number one, but I have actually heard more good things than bad. So I might slide it into the pull list at some stage. All right, guys. Well, I've got my wow factor, and I'm just going to have to blow you guys out of the water. I'm sorry, because this may be the greatest wow factor ever. If we had stirring music, I'd insert it here.
maybe I will.
That'd be awesome, man. Building to a crescendo, because this goes back to before I was born. It predates me by about 6 months. It's December 1981. I've decided to go back into the vault, and it's an issue number 10 from Marvel. And all I really need to say are the three words that are on the cover. We've got the title and we've got the caption. And they are this. Sorry, I'm speaking as if there is music behind me. The three words are Dazzler, Enter Galactus. Game over. Game over, man. Like, Dazzler and Galactus, like, it does not get any better than that, quite honestly. Like, I just think that that's genius. And the reason it's my wow factor this week is because it just personifies that idea that this is comics, man. Go hard. Like, there is no budget. There are no real restraints. You've got some disco chick on rollerblades. Why not throw in the Devourer of Worlds? Like, you can do it. You can make her a Herald of Galactus, and it still fits. Like, don't be a pussy. Write hard. Write something that's no one's going to see coming. Write something that people will remember, because you look at this cover, and it's got her sort of flashing Galactus in the eyes. I'm not flash. Oh, that sounds like she's exposing herself.
It sounds like you found a, this is like a porno version of the X-Men.
Maybe it's one I drew myself, whatever. no, but she's like sort of bedazzling him in the eyes, which could still be exposing herself. But it's just an awesome idea. Like, it's And I've been sort of – I picked this up at a big book fair. It was 50 cents. Haven't even read the issue yet, but it's just been percolating in the back of my head for about the last fortnight that just, you know, with your story, when you're having that next pass over the synopsis draft, which I've been doing on a story idea recently, see if you can insert something that isn't the obvious, is something that will knock people over. And that doesn't necessarily need to be something celestial or cosmic, but – man, make it something. Make it something big. Make it something interesting. So I think Dazzler Enter Galactus, man, from 1981, they were swinging hard. Now, I'm not sure if they connect or not. They might maybe a strikeout, but they're swinging hard, and I respect the hell out of that. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the exact reason what I love about Butcher Baker is that Joe Casey, you know, these books, you know, books have the sales have gone down. Everybody knows this. And Joe Casey decided to write something, just go all the way, like don't even pull any punch, just do it, just do what you want, and you know, just let the chips fall where they may. And the book is just, you know, I know that Michael of Image Addiction does not like it, and he has stated in the episodes that he refuses to read it but I mean, just from the teasers alone, I was just like, I have to read this. Like, I have no idea what's going on, but it's such a bizarre kind of intense, these images that were going up, that I was just like, I have to get in on this. And yeah, that's what I love about it, is that he's going all the way.
If you want to talk about, you know, swinging hard and going all the way, my other wow factor this week would have to be Kurt's Facebook profile picture.
Oh, totally. Like, oh my God. I've stared at that a couple times this week, and I shake my head. I'm like, what is he thinking? Why isn't that?
Can we make it so that when the podcast plays on people's like iPhones, that picture comes up on their phone? Because that would be, that'd be shocking and alarming.
Yeah, maybe I can get Jeremy to help me with that. Yeah, it was pretty funny. I posted up the Jess and I are hosting a Halloween party at our place, and my friend Rob Blizzard, who actually did the logo for Green Wake, interestingly enough, he posted it that picture on the wall, and He said something to the effect of, you know, the expectation has been set. So I was like, this is great. Because if you look at it from a distance, it's like, that looks real. And even when you, like, open it up and zoom in, it still looks like, yeah, this is the best Photoshop I've ever seen.
I remember
seen.
Looking at that photo and thinking, why does Prince Leia look like Kurt?
I was more thinking, why does Kurt look like he wants to seduce me? But that's just what I see in the picture. Maybe it's a Rorschach test. I don't know. I did print it extra large and put it on the roof in the bedroom, so maybe I'm reading it.
Oh, God, that's scary. Well, I guess this is the part where we move on to the progress report, where we talk about what we've been up to in the last few weeks since we had our last podcast. And since I'm doing the intro, I'll talk a little bit what my week was like. This week, now I had had a very successful week the week before, and I was able to get quite far ahead on my personal scripts, but I hadn't had a lot of time to focus on the paid work, which is kind of why I quit driving to begin with. So I was able to actually pound out a lot of scripts for these guys that are hiring me to develop some of their properties, and it actually has been quite a lot of fun. They're called Day 21 Studios, and they're progress on a series called Sky Pirates. They started off with, I believe it was 2 or 3 years ago, they had Sky Pirates of Neoterra come out in with Image Comics. And what they're doing now is they're developing it in a few different ways, and I'm developing web content for them. So I'm writing scripts that Camilla Derrico, who did the original art for it, is illustrating, and it's going to be put up on their website and just for extra material, I guess, for their project. They're also developing video games and all kinds of things with us. So it's been actually quite a lot of fun. And in the meantime, I have totally let my personal projects fall to the wayside, and I haven't really done any, hasn't been much progress in that. But I've been learning a lot about what it means to work for yourself and to manage your time correctly. And I think I had this really, I guess, unrealistic expectation that I would be working Monday to Friday. I'd get up at 8:30 and I would work till 5 o'clock, and that would be my day. And it just has not worked out that way. So I've been learning how to schedule my time that actually works for my lifestyle, I guess. And so I find that I work in pieces. And I think as a creative person, that's kind of how it goes. There are mornings when you wake up and you have all the inspiration in the world, and you can work for 8 hours, and it's not really a big deal. But There are days when I sit down and I just cannot focus and I cannot get a single thing written, so I just have to make up for it the next day. On top of that, I've had some my last, I guess, round of edits for my novel, which is due in 2 days. I've been working on that a little bit. And that book comes out November 18th, and it's called Between Worlds. It's coming out with Bundoran Press. And that's been an interesting experience. I've talked a bit about it before, but it's actually doing this whole process has actually been something that has got me interested in maybe tackling another novel. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see if that's something. And I wouldn't be in the same vein. I would actually like to write a kind of a mistaken identity story set in the 60s. And kind of like a... yeah, but I recently watched the movie. I saw Scott Kwalchuk recommended Charade.
Okay.
Which was awesome. So good. Had Hepburn in it and Cary Grant. And man, was it a tight script. Funny, really funny. Really well acted. And I just, there was something really, really interesting about it. And that's kind of a, you know, mistaken identity and, you know, who's on the take and who's not and who's playing who. And I loved it. I loved it from the minute I started watching it right to the end. So, yeah, something like that has really inspired me. And who knows, maybe I'll, in the next few months, sit down and try to write another novel. So despite not a lot of personal projects getting done, I've learned a lot about the business aspect of my, of what I'm doing now. And yeah, that's been my progress.
That's not bad, man. You say you didn't get much done. Sounds like you're pressing through. That's good. That's very good. Jeremy, what's your progress, man?
Progress has been up and down. Earlier this week, I met with an investor who is, looking to maybe help fund some of my comic book work. Long story short,
how did you contact with somebody like that?
I have a mutual friend who used to be a male model in New York, and he's one of this guy's clients. And this guy, you know, makes a lot of money. He was he's a Wall Street trader, or was a trader. Used to work for a bunch of hedge funds, and you know, my friend was like, "Look, he's looking to help creative people with their projects. Do you want to meet him?" I was like, absolutely. So I went to a meeting in Midtown in this really fancy office, and you know, I meet with him and we sit down and I quickly show him what I have, and then he looks at it and he really finds it engaging, and then he sits back and then he tells me about his life in about 45 minutes. And the gist of it is that he made a lot of money very quickly, basically making rich people richer. And his grandmother was on her deathbed and she basically asked him, you know, "What are you doing with your life?" And he realized what he had been doing wasn't very valuable, and it wasn't leaving anything behind. So that made him realize that he wanted to get out of what he was doing, or focus less on it and help other people, you know, achieve their goals and their dreams. And yeah, he really liked what I had to show, and he wanted to help me. And he was like, you know, I have a lot of ties to Hollywood, and you know, I want to get this in their hands. How do I do that? I said, well, I need to get published first. And I thought that he was kind of like bullshitting about how much money he makes. But at the end of the meeting, he says, there's a black Lincoln Town Car on the corner of the street downstairs. He's my driver. He'll take you wherever you need to go free of charge. And I say, really? He's like, just one of the perks of having a meeting with me.
Oh.
So I go downstairs. There's a Lincoln Town Car sitting there. I say, take me to Brooklyn. And the guy takes me to Brooklyn.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And then I had the following day I had some relationship woes, which I mentioned to you guys about. And then I pitched two comic books to a publisher this week, and both of them got rejected, which was quite a blow to the confidence. But I did at the same time have two meetings with two artists for new projects. I met with this girl, Selena Golding, who is a Toronto-based artist who's working on my Twin Peaks meets Toy Story comic. And then the biggest...
What was that? Twin Peaks meets Toy Story?
Yeah. And then the biggest advance was I met with this guy, Isaac Goodhart, who is a friend of Edwin's, who's the artist of Skull Kickers, who I'm friends with Edwin, and he put me in contact with his friend. And we had a meeting yesterday and pitched this. Basically, it's a period piece set in 1940s New York. It originally had Scott Kowalczyk attached to it, and then Oni slammed him with all this work, so he had to step down. But Isaac loves period pieces. He loves research. So we had a meeting. It was great. And he told me that Edwin wants to do the covers, which was amazing. So that was that's basically the week.
Damn, man, you network like nothing else. I love it.
Yeah.
It's always connections with somebody, man. It is. It's fantastic. And I'm starting to try and abuse some of these connections that you've got, which is really good.
Yeah, please do.
All right, so in my progress report, there's a lot of little stuff, so I'll start smashing through it. The first one is, and this was going back a little while, I wrote a short film script with my brother, James Lindsay, who is an avid listener of the process as well. Hey, bro. We wrote a short film script called Soap, and it's basically about a guy who has to wash his hands every hour, sort of like an OCD thing, and the twist comes in the short film that he gets caught in a bank when a heist goes down, and obviously the robbers would prefer he sits still. So when that hour comes up, what's he going to do? It's a cool, tight little short film script. It goes for about 8-10 minutes, and we managed to sell that to a production company over the last month. So they're putting together budget and cameras and locations and all that sort of stuff. So hopefully sooner rather than later that will be made. Yeah, it's really cool. It'd be nice to – my brother's written another short film that was made maybe 2 years ago now. It's called The Pessimist. It's a really cool little film. It's about like a guy who's a janitor at a shopping center and he just sees the worst in every situation sort of thing. Like he'll walk past some people and they're like, yeah, I'm going holidaying this weekend. I'm going to get on the jet ski. And so in his mind, this guy imagines – the jet ski having an accident and a plane crashing into him and sharks eating him and all that sort of stuff. So it's a real funny little short film. I think you can find it on YouTube. James, put it on the Process Facebook page for us. All right, I'm speaking to the audience. Sorry. So we had that sell, so that was really good. Other than that, I've got sort of three different pitches working at the moment, and I'm just in a state of waiting for either sketches or different things to sort of come in. So I haven't been as actively working on those projects at the moment because most of them, the pitches are all sort of where I want them. I'm just waiting on the artists to sort of fill in the gaps a little bit. So they're not in a holding pattern. They're just sort of spinning their wheels a little bit, which isn't the end of the world, but it's freed me up to work on a bit of other stuff. And I sort of felt like because I wasn't working on those, it hasn't felt like I've worked on anything, to be honest. But I've been cooking up this new idea, which I'm calling the Coffee Club to start off with. And it's about like a bunch of guys sort of entering their 30s and they only really catch up, every fortnight for a coffee because that's sort of all they can manage. They're not big boozers anymore. And what they'll do is they'll eventually see this regular who comes in every week and they finally recognize him as being a villain from the 80s or whatever. And when they go to sort of chase him down, the guy sort of attacks them and they end up getting into a bit of a brawl with him and they actually kill him. And so they end up with his weapon, his power. And so it comes down to, what does this group of buddies, what do they do with this weapon? And I mean, ultimately they don't hand it in, they don't turn it in, they sort of decide to use it. And sort of it stems from there as to, the acceptance of responsibility and due force and how much change you can actually affect in the world while still being, how they say absolute power corrupts absolutely. What will happen to this group? So it's kind of like that Simpsons episode where the boys all get the Radioactive Man #1 comic, but kind of different. So I've been cooking up that idea and it's been really good. I've been thinking, how can I put my Galactus into that story? And so I'm spreading the mythos of it and it's coming together really well. So it's a good idea that I'm sort of pushing around in the background, which is always fun. I'm also working on a webcomic idea. There's another guy who listens to this podcast and he's a really good artist. He does a webcomic called No Dice. And him and I want to do a webcomic called Noir Elementary, and it's basically all your pulp heroes in primary school. And so they go to the Continental Elementary School, and there'd be Parker, there'd be Cora there. I want Fu Manchu to be there, all those sorts of characters. And they have to solve a murder. Their favorite teacher, Mrs. Five, winds up found dead one morning. And so they're trying to piece together the pieces of the puzzle and they end up going to Dunwich Elementary where Lovecraft and other horror writers are, and they'll go to Crom High with our mate Robert E. Howard as an adolescent, and a few of those Edgar Rice Burroughs, those sorts of guys. And I want to do this webcomic as updating twice a week for a year, so I want 104 pieces, and I know that. And so I'm just sort of I'm working on the back end of it, and I'm working on the start, and I'm putting together some notes, and the artist has been putting together Mike. He's been doing a few sketches of the characters, and it feels like it's going to come together really well. And I like this idea because it's not sapping all my time, but it's something that will be published in a word because it will go out there and it will be finite, so it will sort of wrap up. And maybe even after it's finished, you know, who knows, we could self-publish a run or something like that. So I've been working on that. So all those sorts of things sort of add up to my progress report. It's just sort of – it's been little things here and there. It's been kind of good. I don't feel like I've been overly consumed by anything, although sometimes it's nice to be consumed by a project. But the last bit on my progress report really is I've been thinking about Emerald City Comic Con, and I'm wondering if I turned up to that to pitch as an Australian, as someone who flies across the world, would I be remembered? Would that help me?
Your accent helps.
The pitch process. Could I talk Eric Stevenson into submission by just using the dulcet tones? I don't know.
Anything. He's not gonna. He's gonna be like a brick wall. You just got to pitch. just you know, as long as he doesn't say no, this isn't for us, you can be hopeful.
Is that something you're actually considering doing?
To a degree, yeah. It's an expensive prospect. That's the problem. It's thousands of dollars. And so that's a lot of money to throw at a hidden hope, really. So while it's something I'm considering, it's certainly not something I'm doing just yet. But I don't know. Like, I don't want to fly halfway across the world for a weekend that amounts to nothing. But that,
right.
I mean, you can't say it's not going to, but you can't do it knowing it's an investment I can pay back later. So it's somewhere in the middle, I guess. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that you know, from my experiences of going to cons, I've heard amazing things about Emerald City, because every publisher goes there. And, you know, I've been to New York Comic Con's coming up in 2 weeks. It'll be my second time going. Most of the publishers are there. I wouldn't say all of them. But from what Curtis talks about, I think it would totally be worth the money. And I am definitely going to try to go next year. I can't even remember when it is. Curtis, when is it?
I think it's right. In April this year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would say go. Like I mean, if you're going to do it, Emerald City is a good one. And like Jeremy said, it's a good con because there's all of the indie guys are there. Yeah. Pretty much all of them are there. It's not so big that you're going to be waiting in line for 15 minutes to talk to any other creators or, you know, to talk to the editors. It's literally like you can walk up to most of those guys and you would have contacts. You know, I'll be there. And so I can point you to the people you need to talk to rather than just floating around these tables and handing it to people who just sell books, you know, which happens.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, if you come with a good stack of pitches, like if you bring three or four really solid pitches and just say, well, you know, say as part of your pitch, I've come from Australia to hand this to you today, I think that would set you apart for sure.
And that's what I think. I wonder how much I could, to be honest, game the system and abuse that and just sort of be like, sell my story as well as sell the stories that I've written, and just sort of be like, look, I had to kill and sell my pet kangaroo, and I flew here on the wings of a wombat, and that sort of stuff. Like, I don't know, I think I could parlay it into standing out from the crowd, which sounds like, you know, I'm taking advantage of any sort of situation, but shit, I mean, yeah, my accent should count for something.
I mean, Ryan, totally, because, you know, Kurt can agree with me. There was a guy that we met that he's part of the of Nathan Edmondson's message boards, this guy Khan, who's a very nice guy. He was willing to put me up for a couple nights at Fan Expo, and he finished a graphic novel. He finished the entire thing, and he shows up when I meet him, and he's got the thing in a brown bag. And he says to me, he's like, I'm just going to hand this to Eric Stevenson. And I was like, I don't know about that. And then Curtis had a look at it. Riley looked at it. Riley was the first one to say, don't do that. Because what that comes across as is that, you know, you may not be saying it, but handing someone a stack of papers like that is basically saying, I've poured my blood, sweat, and tears in this. You better like it because I spent my life on it. And it's this negative connotation. But the way you're doing it is very different. It's very genuine. You're not shoving them a bunch of stuff. You've come prepared. So it's kind of very tight pitches. And you know, if Khan's listening to this, he knows that we're right. He changed it. He picked 5 to 10 pages from his book to show, and he's coming for New York Comic Con, so he's going to hopefully change that. But yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll be something I think about for the future. I mean, I got a few months, and whether we can get the money together or whether we can afford the money for that, because it's a big mental block to get past, because it's almost like throwing that money away, although it would be a wicked experience. I mean, if any listeners want to donate to me, go ahead.
Awesome. Well, we should maybe move on to the next section. I think we're at 35 minutes here.
Yep.
All right, sweet. Let's look at – we got an email from Nolan for the Grillum section, and he asks us, boys, at what point does the time and energy of a project put you in a place where you highly suggest to others, just learn from my mistakes? In other words, what were your biggest time sinks that you'd advise others to avoid? Now, I know the big one I would say here is biggest thing to avoid, procrastination. And it sounds so obvious, but – I mean, I spent 4 years at uni, and I had a lot of spare time on my hands, and I always sort of had plans. Oh, I'll write this. Oh, I'll write that. I had an idea. I was going to – the college I lived in had a weekly newsletter, and I was going to write an ongoing serial. And what was the name of it? The main character was Jimmy Mann. It was going to be The Trouble with Jimmy Mann, I think. And basically what it was is this guy was in the first episode – going to go to the uni pub, and you'd be having a night out, and then he'd go to the bathroom, and then stage fright would hit. And so then in the next episode, each time he'd have another reason to get stage fright. So whether it was a fight broke out in the bathroom, or some dude was creepily licking his lips staring at him while he was standing at the urinal, or someone came in and vomited right in front of him, and I was going to have all these different weeks of stage fright. Not the greatest story in the world, certainly nothing I'll be pitching to Image, but it was an idea. I had to write it, and I never got around to it because – and I've said it before, drinking wine out of a bag seemed too alluring. So don't procrastinate, listeners. Just write. Write every day. Yeah. Every night, too.
Yeah, I agree with you. Procrastination is definitely something that I have to manage, because it's a lot easier now to just – before, like, I had this ridiculous schedule that I've kind of swung the other end of the pendulum, where I'm just like – I have way more time now, but it's like I just can't seem to focus. And – you can come up with any kind of excuse. You really can. Like, oh, well, I had a late night last night. I deserve this day off. Or, you can come up with a lot of reasons not to do what you need to do. But at the end of the day, you can put in, you can put in 2 to 3. It depends on your schedule, I guess. But, you know, for me, I can put in 10 hours a day if I want to, and I could be really, really productive. But yeah, don't allow the excuses, the amount of power that will take away from your overall progress, because – yeah, procrastination, it's the death of creativity. I definitely agree.
I guess my two cents is page rates. With page rates, I've realized, and I only realized it when I was talking to Riley during Fan Expo, and I don't know if Riley, if you listen to this podcast, but Curtis, I'm sorry, but I love Riley Rossmo. Like, I'm going to totally encroach on your territory here and just say Riley Rossmo is awesome, because, you know, he shed some light on the – you know, he's an artist, obviously, and he said, look, page rates don't belong in creator-owned comics. And I thought about that, and I said, well, you know, I'm a nobody. You know, I want an artist to work on my book. I feel like I have to pay them or they're not going to work on it. And he said, no, look, and I think we've discussed this before, but on the show, that the artists that want a page rate don't necessarily want to make a comic book. The ones that really want to make a comic book and understand the process of making one know the time commitment. And Curtis, you and Riley have this awesome relationship, and it shows, and the work is good, and the book is amazing. And, Riley said that any comic book artist should know that the IP is what they want, because, you know, that's potential. You know, Riley was talking about, his advantage of having IP with Cowboy Ninja Viking, and that superseded any page rate he could have asked for. And that's what I've realized, is that, you know, I worked with an artist who's a well-established artist. I did 40 pages with him, and I realized I spent almost $3,000 that I can no longer use because he has gone MIA. So, you know, that sucks. And, it's just a mistake you have to learn, and I realized that moving forward, I just want to work with artists that want to make a comic book, and the artists that I've linked up with, the two that I mentioned earlier, you know, understand that I'm putting together a pitch, so there's no money up front, but, you know, they get a 50% IP share, they get back-end pay and all that, and, you know, they were totally cool with that, so.
I wonder how many artists are listening to this writer's podcast and thinking, like, oh, I want to get paid, or that's not fair, like, you know, it takes longer to draw a page, or blah, blah, blah. I'm really interested, because most of the artists I come across in my artist ongoing searches, eternal searches, most of them want page rates, and yeah, I don't agree with it, to be honest. I just think it's an amalgamation. It's a collaboration. I'm not saying they're piggybacking on the writer's ideas, but if they want that eventual end product, why should they get paid throughout it? And I actually have worked with an artist once for page rates, and it actually worked out really, really well. The pitch never got picked up, but we're still actually great mates, and we chat all the time. He works for Oni now, but that worked for me to a degree, but it was because we still had a very open collaboration process. But I couldn't do page rates every time, that's for sure. I don't know how some people – I don't know where you found the money, Jeremy. I think that was crazy. That was definite commitment.
You know, the difference with paying a page rate is that when you don't, you put the responsibility on both creators. And I think Curtis and Riley can agree. They put responsibility on their project for Green Wake, and – you know, I know Edmondson has never paid a page rate, and, you know, granted, Who Is Jake Ellis has kind of floundered because of that, because I think Tanchi took more work, but, you know, I just want to work with someone that is 100% collaborative. And the advantage of that, if any artist is listening out there, is that you can give your two cents on the project. You can say, look, I don't think this is working. I want to, you know, maybe we should try this direction. And if you're paying a page rate, you have no say. You draw what I fucking send you, because you're getting. And if I'm not giving you money, then I want to hear feedback. And like, I had this meeting with Isaac Goodhart yesterday, and, you know, I gave him the spiel of what the story is about, what I, from my perspective. And he's like, you know, I was thinking a completely different thing, and he pitched it to me, and it was amazing. And I took notes, and I said, you know, you've opened my mind, because I had this project intended for a different artist, and you're willing to go in a different direction, and that's great, because I was kind of stuck. And, you know, I told him, I was like, this is 100% collaborative. And we were talking about Skull Kickers and Edwin and a couple other things. And he interrupted, and he's like, I don't want to talk about money per se, but I was hoping I could get a co-creator credit. And I was like, dude, you're getting 50% IP. And he's like, oh, my God, this is amazing. This is my dream. I was like, you know, this is how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be fun. And, you know, sitting there, it's weird, but I was thinking about Curtis. I was like, he had this with Riley, and that is awesome. And you know, other writers out there, if you can find an artist that lives in your city, take them over someone that doesn't, because just being able to talk it out, you know, that is beyond email, is such an advantage.
The excitement really builds, and it's something that, you know, it that momentum keeps building the longer that you are, you know, developing the project. And I would totally agree with that advice for sure. I mean, that would be a priority. Unfortunately, Ryan moved out of the city that I live in now, and he's gone on to move to Calgary, but, you know, we still stay in touch, but it is way better when you can sit down and talk in person. So I agree with that.
Definitely. And I think with the last thing on that topic is, some people see, like, if you write a bunch of Marvel scripts, you know, on spec, and they're never going to get published, and they're the first things you wrote, that's sort of a waste of time, or that you should avoid that sort of thing. And I know I've mentioned this before. I kind of disagree. I think even if you plotted some 200-issue magnum opus thing that didn't plan out, hopefully you learned something from doing that. I mean, if you weren't doing that, were you going to be working on a pitch that was going to sell? It's hard to tell. So I don't know. I think the biggest thing is, don't lose too much money, but don't procrastinate. Like, writing is writing, and you can't expect your first pitch to sell. We're not all Jonathan Hickman. So be realistic about it, I think, kids.
Okay, so I guess we're going to move on to the process, which is the heart of the meat of this discussion, which is basically – for this episode, we're talking about the art of the artist search. What are the most important things to consider about your own project when looking for an artist? So I guess, Curtis, you have the most experience with this, obviously, because your projects have gone through. So tell us about it.
Sure. One of the best examples that I can give, or pieces of advice I can give, is when you are writing a script, there's one of two things you can do. You can write a script with an artist in mind. And if you have seen somebody's art on DeviantArt, or if you've been put in touch with somebody who has a website and you like the look of it, write a script that is tailored to their strength. If you do it the other way, which is you write the script and try to attach an artist, when you're emailing or getting in contact with them, make sure right out of the gates it's a style of story that they're interested in. I'll give you an example. Riley and I, when we first started hanging out and getting to know each other, this was a few years ago now, I actually pitched to him my first comic series, Beautiful Creatures, wow, which is totally not a Riley book whatsoever. It is so far from being a Riley book that, I mean, he should have never have talked to me again just for the audacity. But what I learned through working with him is that, you know, you kind of got to do your homework. You got to research kind of, if they have previous comic books out or if they have a website, really take a look and do your research as to what kind of stuff they're interested in. And either write a script that will get them excited, or if you've already written it, like I said, make sure that you're approaching the right artist about it. I had the same thing with Tyler Jenkins, who my new series Peter Panzerfaust is with, and I did Snow Angel with. I think I did talk to him about Intrepids, actually. And as soon as I started telling him about it, I was like, he just kind of had this dead look in his eyes, and he's just like, don't even bother finishing this pitch. I'm not interested. And I should have known that because it's just not Tyler's style of art. And so I think that's really one of the major, major important things that you need to take into consideration is what exactly excites them to draw.
Yeah, that is a really good point. They say that a lot, like in the big companies, that the writer will ask the artist, what do you want to draw? And they'll say, oh, you know, I want to draw a big tentacle monster. And they'll fit that in, and it usually works well because the artist is happy with what they're doing and they're invested in it. So, you know, I think those are really smart words.
Yeah, I mean, when as a writer, the important thing, and I think that what Curtis is doing, which I hope to see as a trend with new writers, is that he's branching out and he's writing new material. He's not, you know, okay, for example, Steve Niles. I love the guy. He's great. I think what he does is amazing. But he does adhere to a horror genre, which, you know, is inherently limiting. Curtis is writing, you know, he wrote Green Wake, which is, you know, to me, a Twin Peaks comic book, which is amazing, and I love every page of it. And he wrote Intrepids, which, you know, appealed to a whole different audience. And now he's about to write this punk rock story that, and also, you know, another kind of Quantum Leap story. And he's just branching out. And I think, Curtis, what you're going to do ultimately, whether you realize it or not, is you're going to bridge the gap between these audiences. And I think that anybody, any writer out there, you know, you might have an idea, but I'm sure that someone has already done it, which isn't a discouragement. I'm not saying don't do it, but, you know, find an artist like, you know, Ryan said and Curtis has said to, you know, see what they want to do, because it's a good writing exercise to write something that you wouldn't normally write. And bottom line, you need them to draw it. So, you know, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really good advice, man. Just the last bit that you said there, and I totally agree with that, where use that as an exercise to really test your skills. And I don't know that I've actually done that. I have a lot of friends who are artists, so you just end up talking about these things and these projects bloom out of those conversations. But that's a really interesting way. If you see someone on a DeviantArt and, you know, they talk about their passion for comics, write a script for them, and just, even if it's a 5-page or 6-page, and say, hey, I wrote this for you because I really like your art, and I've got some, I'm Jeremy Connections Holt, so, you know, we're going to get this bitch made. So I think that's a really good piece of advice. I like that.
A big thing I found with artists, and you look at their stuff on DeviantArt, one of the first things I always ask them is, how long did it take you to make that page? Because I've seen some glorious samples, and they're like, yeah, I spent, like, you know, 4 months on that page. That's not going to work for a 22-page book.
Yeah, that's true. That's also good advice.
I mean, that's basically what's – the idea that I just mentioned stemmed from this idea that I had to pitch to Scott Kowalczyk. And, you know, I basically asked him, I said, what kind of stories do you want to write? And he said he'd been wanting to write an old-timey monster book, but he couldn't come up with a monster that hadn't already been done. So the gist of Primordial, which is the story that I'm working with Isaac, is basically 1940s New York. It focuses on New York City's first criminal profiler, which didn't exist. The first criminal profiler actually existed about 50 years earlier, which was the Jack the Ripper case. And there was nobody in America that did it. So my story is about this guy who's a PI, a private investigator, who, you know, is more interested about other people's fiction, and he's more interested in psychology and anatomy, which aids in his police work, and he's a much more effective detective because of that. So he basically, his one of his cases deals with this basically this primordial monster who, you know, he's good at what he does, and he understands how criminals work, and he understands the psyche of a criminal, but this one criminal he's dealing with has no motive, which to anybody who's trying to figure out a crime is absolutely just crazy, because you can't basically figure out their next move. So I was writing this for Scott, and I know his sensibilities with Intrepids, and you know, he's quirky and he doesn't like super dark, he doesn't like violence, so it was a great exercise to write that for him, and I did a really good job and he really liked it. But when he dropped out, you know, that was also very interesting, because I was so set in my way on that story that when I met Isaac and he had new ideas, it was very refreshing to be like, okay, you know, I can actually step back and re-examine this project. So
that's a cool idea. I like that story idea, man. I think that's got legs.
Thank you.
No, that's all right. I don't think I've got anything to add to that, guys. That, yeah, the big thing is, yeah, match the artist to the tone. That's, I truly believe in that. Like, I've got one great artist on my cryptozoological heist book. I didn't really offer him the Bubblegum Mystic book for a reason. Like, there's no point asking someone to bend over in the strange positions that it's going to break them in the end. All right, yeah, so we can move on, I think, to the round table, where we're going to go around and we're going to discuss revisions tonight. And we're going to talk about when it becomes detrimental to the process and think about how important is a script editor and or a proofreader. Jeremy, you've probably been revising a lot of stuff recently. What are your thoughts on revisions and the limits that you need to go with them?
You know, I think that it's very important to have a second pair of eyes, because you could revise, and I think Ryan, you actually said it in one of the episodes about, you know, revising something to the point where you're rewriting the same original sentence.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, it's important, and I've had a couple script editors, unofficial script editors. My oldest brother, who, you know, was a huge comic book fan growing up, he became my unofficial editor, he was very helpful, because he'd read something, and it was mostly syntax stuff, and he just posed questions. Like, he wasn't saying, you know, this is wrong, this is right, but he said, well, why are you saying this? And recently another guy, Nolan, who happened to provide the question for the podcast, he's also, you know, he's a film major, he knows how to tell stories, he's got a lot of great material, and he was very instrumental in Lucid or Sleepwalker, which was the last pitch I pitched to Eric Stevenson at Fan Expo. And I think it's important, because, you know, you can, you know, dissect it every day, and it might get actually worse. And I see the purpose of an editor. And an editor, you know, honestly, shouldn't just be a bully, because I feel like that was my impression of an editor. It was just a bully to get you to do it right. But the good editors that I've read about are the ones that encourage you and you know, want to make you better, basically. So,
yeah, it is about that motivation sometimes where, I mean, do you guys have, like, little sample groups that you send scripts out to get a bit of a feel for?
The first people I send my scripts to is the artist. And, I think for me, that's the most important first initial response. I recently finished up Green Wake #8. And as soon as it was done, I sent it to Riley. Like, the second I finished my first draft, I didn't even go over it again.
Oh shit.
And I sent it to him, and he read it over, and he's like, okay, he felt it was the best script, you know, as far as the story was concerned. He's like, but, you know, I want you to go back and just reread some of the dialogue, because it feels like you're missing, you're falling out of character on some of the dialogue. So I read through it again. And I'm like, yeah, he's right. There's a couple points of dialogue where I had lost the characterization. And so I find that's my best way to refine my stuff really quickly. I just send my first draft out to an artist, or, you know, sometimes I just even sound, not even the script itself, but the structure of the story. A good sounding board is my girlfriend, my partner, who will just kind of give me some feedback on, you know, some of the ideas that I'm having, or just, you know, we bounce ideas back and forth. And I find those two things together in the early stages of a script, or in your first draft, are really, really instrumental in the final product.
Yeah, that's interesting. That I think the artist, you're right, has got to be sort of that first touch base, especially if they're sort of half in on the project. They should really see what's happening, and then sending out those story beats, things like that. I mean, earlier this year, I was working on a one shot that Kurt was looking over, and Kurt, you gave some really good editorial advice, to be honest, and you weren't heavy-handed at all, which I don't know, it kind of threw me off. It was, you were secretly manipulative, I guess. I didn't see it coming. You were just like, I know there was one thing I put in the script, and from the first mention of it, I could tell it was pretty obvious Kurt didn't want it in there, and I was just kind of like, yeah, well, I'll put it in there and I'll see how you like it in script form. And so I worked it in the script, and you were like, nah, maybe you could change it. And so I had another pass at the script and sort of still left it in there, and basically you were like, why don't you change it to this? And so there was that real guiding process, and that worked really well, because I think, to be honest, you were right. And I can remember we did a fair bit of back and forth on this script, and at one stage I think it was in an email, and it was such a short email, and all you just said was just give it one more pass, you'll see what needs to go. And it was really, really powerful words. It was basically you probably just being lazy as hell. But it's like, I don't want to read it anymore, Ryan. Just do it yourself. But no, you were just like, just give one more pass. You'll see what needs to go. And I did. I read through it, and I could see a few things that needed to be tweaked. And that was, probably a solid month that you and I sort of went back and forth on that. And I think in the end, the script was pretty tight, and it certainly went through some serious revisions in that time, and there were some moderate changes, there were some structural changes, but it came through in the end. And I think a lot of that, Kurt, was due to your sort of your well-placed editorial words. And well, I think it's important to find someone that can do that.
I thanks, man, I appreciate that. I mean, that also came from a place where I'll just come out and say it, because I'll be honest, I'm not done with this script that you've written yet. I still want to do something with it. So Ryan cool. I had actually approached Ryan about doing a fill-in for Green Wake.
What?
And, so he actually wrote an awesome, like, it is a really awesome, tight script. And Ryan's touched on it a few times throughout the podcast, but that's the one he's talking about. It's a Green Wake fill-in that I kind of oversaw, because I know all the rules for Green Wake and how it works. I kind of had to help Ryan with those kind of logistical parts of the story, but it is a really good script, and I would still like to actually see if we can get it in there to filler, because that was around the time when we weren't sure how the pacing between the first arc and the second arc. I don't even think the ongoing had been even announced at that point yet, but I think you knew, Ryan, about it. Yeah. So we were just looking for a fill-in, and it ended up being Jim still, I think, was concerned about making sure that, you know, we had a very tight vision with the story, and that we had kind of a repetitive schedule, you know, five issues the trade. But I think now with that, Green Wake's got some legs, and that there, you know, we'll have very soon two arcs under our belt, that I think we'll have a little bit more room to play with. Don't quote me on it, but I'd still love to see that script come to life, because it's really, really good.
Oh, thanks, man. That's nice to hear and recorded for posterity. I'm going to use that as a quote on my tombstone.
Yeah,
because that was a script, man. I loved writing that script, and it's one of the scripts I'm most proud of, because it's a one shot. And man, I love one shots, and they're a killer to write. And I feel like I got this one tight enough, and it fit, and there was still some room for the art to carry some story. And I think it would blend into the mythos of Green Wake, obviously, but it stands to the side as well. It's parallel, so it's not going to affect what you guys are doing. So, man, I would love to see at some stage it get a run. But, I mean, I can understand what Jim's words were, that after you just announce the series as an ongoing and then somebody steps in with another script, you're going to lose readers, and you certainly don't want to do that. So, you know, maybe some stage down the track, but I certainly I won't hold you to anything, mate. That's for sure.
You know,
no worries.
To add to the roundtable, you know, something that I think we've all learned is networking, and you know, as far
we've learned it from you, but yeah.
Well, I mean, the advantage is when you're pitching at a con. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, whoever's listening has gone through the steps they've had to get something ready for a con, and they pitch. Rather than basically going on a blind date, it's best to become friends with the best friend of the blind date. So, you know, Ryan and I have, whether we planned it or not, became friends with Curtis, and, you know, Curtis has immediate experience and a relationship and a rapport with editors. So it's helpful for him to, you know, give us guidelines. And, you know, to be honest, when I think about pitching to an editor, it's like pitching to someone where you have to basically figure out their sensibility without knowing them at all. So it's daunting, and you pitch something and you realize, oh my God, they hated that. That wasn't even something they wanted to even hear about for 3 seconds, and you talked about it for 5 minutes. So anybody out there, honestly, you know, reach out and network with creators. Like, it'll expand your circle. I think that the creators that really break in are the ones, I think Nolan mentioned it to me earlier this week, where he said that he believed that creative teams now in this generation of comic books is they're breaking in as teams, and they have a band of guys that they can use as a sounding board. They have a band of guys that maybe one has, you know, gotten through the door and he's giving advice to the others, because it's you know, basically in this industry, it's, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours with the good creators. And you know, I think that it's important to, you know, write your scripts, but go out there and talk to people and just shake hands and meet people.
I'm almost certain, Jeremy, that you're the same. We haven't done this in a nefarious way.
Right.
We're not just like, oh, let's be friends with, Kurt. Yeah, let's just pick him randomly. He annoys the piss out of me, but I'll keep chatting to him. Like, if you do it that way, I think you would get found out really, really quickly. And I know through writing for CBR and the Weekly Crisis as well, I've chatted with a lot of creators. But like with Kurt, there were a lot of things that it helped that the interview I did with him took like 2 weeks. So there was a lot of chatter there. But he's a guy that's right on my level in so many ways. And it helped that Greenwake is a book that I was super passionate about even before I knew Kurt. Yes. That was a book that I stand behind and I still do completely. And I wonder if people think, oh, you know, I only spruik it because, you know, I'm on the podcast, or I'm, you know, I'm trying to brown nose my way into the industry. And it really isn't that way. With that book, with Greenwake, it is, for me at least, it is phenomenal. And I love seeing the people that I've put onto it, and it just helps that Kurt is an awesome guy and it's worked out that way. And so I think with listeners, if you're going to network with these people, and we've discussed it before with Twitter, don't be heavy-handed about it. Don't be a prick. Just, you know, there will be creators that you agree with and that you'll get on well with, and there'll be others that maybe you don't, and so don't pursue those. It's the same as building friendships in real life. You can't, like, go to high school and just try and find the cool kid and just berate them until you're friends with them and then be part of the cool group. It's got to be organic. And I think once you find those organic relationships, foster them, definitely, because it certainly, I'm sure it won't hurt us in the end, but it is nice to have a springboard like Kurt in the industry that we can bounce ideas off. And I mean, just the opportunity to do this podcast has been something that over the last few months has made me think about a lot of things, and it's helped with a lot of areas. And it's an opportunity, shit, I wouldn't have been close to 2-3 years ago. So it's got to feel... Yeah, I think they've got to be real, real friendships, and you can't turn around. Like, I would never turn around in a year and be like, well, all right, Kurt, I've done 6 articles for you. You got to get this thing published. Like, that would be a dog act, and I don't think the industry would stand for it. Comics feels like such an insular industry that it doesn't tolerate fools, which I think is really good. I mean, I think about, there's a creator at Image who writes a book that I absolutely adore. It's not you, Kurt. But sounded like another way for me to brown nose this terrible. There's another creator in another book, and I won't name him, but I really am passionate about that project. And he sends me very early PDFs so that I can take notes on the issue, and I send those notes back. And sometimes it's structural, sometimes it's story-based, sometimes it's grammatical fix-ups that need to happen with the lettering. But he, through chatter that we've had, he values what I have to say, and I'm more than willing to give him feedback. Now, I'm not going to turn around in a few months and say, oh, well, now you owe me. And I think that's the big thing, and I worry some people do that sometimes. They try to call in the favors.
It's an etiquette.
You don't call in favors with your friends. I think, like, if I help a friend move into his house, I don't bring that up when I have to move house. I ask around, but you don't hold it over people's heads. And we went into that when we talked about networking before, and my big rule was don't be a dick. And I think that still stands.
Well, Curtis, I want to ask you, when you thought about this podcast, what compelled you to talk to someone like Ryan and myself rather than two established creators?
I think you guys, I've been emailing quite a bit just about general, like, interviews and reviews and stuff like that. And I think there was just a lot of level of passion behind even just doing, like, you know, doing reviews or interviews or just talking about comics. And there's a lot of passion there. And I don't know, I felt like it would be interesting to hear, you know, just different perspectives on the comic industry. I know just from the conversations I've had with Ryan that, you know, he's been reading comics for quite a long time. We had a lot of similar interest in film and music. And then just talking with you, you seem to have, you know, you're a more recent comic reader, kind of like myself. And I thought if we could get a lot of different perspectives, it would make the show a lot more interesting. And I think I wanted to be careful, too, not to have a show that was basically just three writers who have comic stuff, you know, published, just sit there and talk about their projects. And I think this is a nice way to, just bring a really, really open perspective to the chat that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise.
So instead, you wanted three guys to sit around and talk about your projects.
Hey, you're doing that on your own. I have no part in that. What? Just the one last thing I want to say before we bring it up to the wrap up here is, just something to do with an editor, working with an editor, and I've had some recent experience with this. I'd written, I guess I can say now it's been solicited, so I actually have some work with Marvel coming out in December, and it's an 8-page thing for their holiday annual, and I'd written the 8 pages, and I'd sent it in, and I was happy with it, you know, I did what I could with the script, and I think I had 3 or 4 revisions total to the 8 pages. And I was like, after the third one, I was like, oh, come on already. I mean, this is good. I don't know what your problem is. Like, I do one draft of my scripts for my projects, and I was getting a little bit irritated. But then the last one they sent back actually was a fairly significant change to the resolution of on the 8th page and actually to the tone even that really changed the entire first 8 pages or first 7 pages in a really interesting way. And that was my first real experience working with a direct editor who obviously has a lot of experience. And I actually learned a really, really important lesson from that is that, you know, I may think that a first or second read through is all I'm going to need for my personal projects. But I've actually taken that lesson from that experience with Marvel. And I go over now and I usually wait a few days and I go back for a third. And then one last time, I do a 4th read over it a few days later, and it's really helped me tighten up the dialogue and the scripts where I've actually revised a full page or 2 pages or even a whole scene where I'm a lot more picky with my stuff now. And I was writing I was finishing Grim Leaper, another project that's coming out next year, and I'd written the pitch script, which is 6 pages, and I had added another 4, and it took me like all day to write it. And at the end of the day, I sat down and looked at it, and I read it once, I read it twice, and I was like, okay, it's okay. I think it's okay. The third time I read it, I'm like, this is garbage, and I deleted the entire thing. Wow. So, I think there's something to be said about giving yourself space to read the proof, take a break, read it again, take a break, and until you have that feeling, and you'll know as a writer, you'll have that gut instinct, you're like, yes, this is exactly what it needs to be, and just go with it. From that point, you have that confidence, just ride that feeling because you're right. Until you get that feeling, just keep going back.
Yeah, I find that. My biggest thing is if in doubt, don't. And there's so many lines or moments in a book where I'm like, oh, I don't know if I should keep it. I don't know if I should keep it. And if I give it 2 days and I come back, I know I shouldn't keep it. And if I was doubtful in the first place, there's probably a reason for that. You got to trust your instincts. And sometimes you got to kill your darlings, as they say. I don't know where that quote's attributed from, but you might think it's a good little line, but if you're feeling iffy about it, yeah, scrap it, man.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid. All right, guys. Well, I think if we're ready to wrap up, listeners, yes, if you thought my intro was anything good, wait until you hear Curtis's outro. Kurt, take it away.
That's unfair. I'm simply going to be reading. I'm just going to be reading a quote, but I think it's a nice kind of addendum to everything we've talked about today. So this is a quote by Ira Glass. Nobody tells this to people who are beginners. I wish someone had told me. All of us who do creative work, we get into it because we have good taste. But there is this gap. For the first couple years, you make stuff. It's just not that good. It's trying to be good. It has potential, but it's not. But your taste, the thing that got you into the game, is still killer. And your taste is why your work disappoints you. A lot of people never get past this phase. They quit. Most people I know who do interesting creative work went through years of this. We know our work doesn't have this special thing that we want it to have. We all go through this. And if you're just starting out or you're still in this phase, you got to know that it's normal. And the most important thing you can do is do a lot of work. Put yourself on a deadline so that every week you finish one piece. It's only by going through a volume of work that you will close that gap and your work will be as good as your ambitions. And I took longer to figure out how to do this than anyone I've ever met. It's going to take a while. It's normal to take a while. You just got to fight your way through. So with that little bit of advice from Ira Glass, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to this episode of The Process. And as usual, we want to give a shout out to the guys at Image Addiction for continuing to host our show. And to our listeners who keep on sending us messages and giving us words of encouragement, we really appreciate it. And we're glad we're doing a fun thing for everyone to enjoy. And we will be talking to you very soon, and we will have a fantastic special guest that I think it's okay for us to announce because this may come out after Definitely. It's done anyway. We will be having, Brian, this, you earned this, so you can announce
Do it.
Guys, we'll be talking to Scott Snyder, superscribe of Batman Swamp Thing and American Vampire. I cannot wait to sit down and talk about his process.
Yes, which is very exciting. We have a list of guests that we are very excited about that we've been forming up over the last few weeks here, and you guys are going to have a lot of awesome content coming your way. So we'll wrap up things for today. We'll have this out in the next few days, I guess, and we will be talking to Scott Snyder. Lots of good things coming. Have a good one.